This is the place, and this is the time. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to change our ways, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song.
I was asked to speak about my thoughts on a religious center. And I would start by saying that the notion of a religious center has, for most of my adult life, been a little strange for me. This is probably due to the idea of religion that was so deeply ingrained in my psyche from the spoon feeding I received day after day, week after week, month after month, and year after year as a child and a young adult. By the time I was 12, I had begun to question the foundation upon which my parents' religion is built. By the time I was in high school, I had rejected it. And as soon as I was on my own, I ended what had become for me nothing more than a charade. The idea of attending church never again entered my mind. Religion, as I understood it, had no relevance for me. You can imagine my surprise 20-plus years later at finding this place, or I should say being drawn into this place. I'm still not sure how I made the transition from Nell Newton's Tai Chi student to church member, RE instructor, board member, board vice president, board president, and now board vice president again, because yes, we do recycle at this church. It's hard for me to say what it was that struck a chord with me and renewed an interest in religion, legitimate religion about life and meaning and purpose. But a chord was definitely struck. The last time I visited my parents, my mom and I went up into Tennessee, as we often do when I'm visiting, to purchase food from a Mennonite community there. It's about an hour and a half drive, a beautiful drive, through the increasingly tall hills of northern Alabama and southern Tennessee that gives us plenty of time to visit with no one else around and no interruptions. As we began the return trip, my mother indicated her desire to discuss religion. Well, I girded my loins. She wanted to try to understand where I'm coming from, because it's certainly not from the center that she and my father had tried to construct for me. Or so she thought. She couldn't understand why, if I didn't believe in a personal God, I bothered with belonging to a church or trying to live a good life. If there's no hell to avoid, no heaven to look forward to, then why not just live it up? It was very strange to hear my mother seemingly recommending a life of hedonism. There was, I realized, a disconnect between the basis of her morality, a belief that morals are the practice of following the laws of God, and the practical benefits of living life in a moral way. So my task was to explain how my humanism and her Christianity were both based on principles that are quite independent of the existence or non-existence of a personal God. In that moment, the moment that I had to try to explain to my fundamentalist Christian mother why I'm a member of this church and why I take this church as seriously as I do, I defined my religious center. My religious center is my humanity. Religion, as I now understand it, is about being more fully human. It's about being more connected to my world and to the people in it. Being concerned for the welfare of others, and not just for strictly altruistic reasons, but because I realize that we all share a common heritage and that we're all bound up in a common future. We are one humanity. What's good for one is good for all, and what's bad for one is bad for all. Petty differences become more, or is it less, than just petty when viewed from this center. And yes, it's a religious center.
A at the center of our service and at the center of our lives. We take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world. Gracious and loving Spirit, we gather together this morning as community in search of meaning, in search of hope, in search of itself. In these trying times when there exists so much pain and poverty, so many opportunities for us to act responsibly, help us to winnow out the seed of action from the chaff of talk. Help us to bring into focus the things that we need to do, to quiet the cavalier voices of those who see poverty as a part of character, and to raise our own standards when it comes to acting upon what we believe. We believe that those on the borders of life deserve more than existence. We believe that the dominant culture must open its arms and embrace those that stand on the margins looking in. Help us, Great Spirit, to see our connections to all that exists, to see that where we live is precisely how we live, that the gathering of the wounded, the hungry, and the poor is as much for us an act of redemption as it is for them. Now open our hearts and minds so that the unexpected and unforeseen can find its way into the solutions of our lives. Prepare us for the magnificence of the moment. We pray this in the name of everything that is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen. One afternoon when I was sitting in my garden, two dogs came down the path to the place where I was seated. I like dogs. I always have. The shorter of the two dogs was broad in the chest and bandy-legged, and she came over to me and she demanded some attention from me with her nose, the way dogs have a tendency to do. So I scratched her back, and she arched approvingly. My eyes then wandered over to the larger black dog who had the yellow close-set eyes of the wolf. I mean, I like dogs, but it pays to be wary. And I noticed that the big black dog was wagging her tail. I stopped scratching that little dog's back, and that big dog stopped wagging her tail. I scratched that little dog's back again, the big dog wagged her tail again. So I did a little experiment. Do you know that each and every time I scratched that little dog's back, that big dog wagged her tail? Finally, the big dog came over, I scratched her back, and the little dog took the part of the tail wagging friend, and I thought, how wonderful, how absolutely wonderful. If only human beings could learn this trick. Scratch one dog's back, all dogs wag their tails. Now, the dogs in my backyard, they weren't going through some difficult mental reasoning, coming to the conclusion that what is good for one is good for all. No! They were connected at a heart level, and at a heart level, we all know what is good for one is good for all. We can learn a lot from our animal friends.
Martin Buber, the great Jewish thinker, in his seminal work, I and Thou, says this about his cat. You see, I'm covering all the people, the dog people and the cat people. Sometimes I look into a cat's eyes. The beginning of this cat's glance, lighting up under the touch of my glance, indisputably questioned me. Is it possible that you think of me? Do you really not just want me to have fun? Do I concern you? Do I exist in your sight? Do I really exist? What is it that comes from you? What is it that surrounds me? What is it that comes from me? What is it? The world of it surrounded the animal and myself. With the space of a glance, the world of thou had shone out from the depths. When was the last time you watched a dog lie down? Sometimes they plop down, but most of the time they go in circles and they paw a lot. Now, I've had this explained to me as the vestiges of their primitive nature back when they were on the steppes and the savannas, when they were more hyena and wolf than dog. They're just breaking down that grass so they can make a nice bed for themselves. Well, in today's sermon, we're going to do a lot of circling. We will be pressing down the tall theological grasses and the symbolic grasses of several traditions. The outcome will hopefully be that in the end, when these words have finished being spoken by my lips and understood and accepted by your willing hearts, we will find a bedrock, a potential religious center, a place to lie down, rest, and view the dizzying activities of the world spinning around us. When my family lived in Sacramento, California from 1952 to 1959, we went to, well, we had to. Sacramento was so boring. We went to San Francisco often. Now, if you've been there, you know all the tourist stuff to see. Knob Hill, Fisherman's Wharf, the trolley cars, Haight-Ashbury, Golden Gate Park, the Presidio, Golden Gate Bridge, Alcatraz, Seal Rock. If you were there in the 50s and 60s, you know there was a restaurant across from Seal Rock called the Cliff House. It might still be there. Up the street from the Cliff House, there was a place called Sutro's. Seven stories, a very interesting thing, everything from player pianos to mummies. And this all surrounded an atrium at the bottom of which was a skating rink. Now, given all this, you'd think that Sutro's was my place that I liked the best, but it wasn't. I liked down the street from the Cliff House, across the street from the ocean, a place called the Fun House. Now, my favorite attraction at the Fun House was a huge disc, I mean really big, that you were invited to sit down on. Now, when everybody was seated, a horn went off and the disc began to revolve slowly, much like a merry-go-round. But this was no merry-go-round, no, sir. There were no painted horses on which to ride, no carriages in which safely to be. No, if you were going to stay on that disc, you were going to have to hold on to the person next to you. As the disc revolved faster and faster, brothers held on to sisters whom they would in no wise otherwise be seen holding on to in public. Estranged wives and husbands grabbed a hold of each other, but to no avail. You see, centrifugal force would have its way, and eventually everyone was thrown from the disc. Everyone except those who had found their way to the center. It wasn't hard to find. Right there it was from the beginning. Not to sit directly on the center meant that centrifugal force would eventually pull you, and little by little you'd lose your center and be thrown off. What I'm suggesting to you today is this. Finding our religious center isn't simply something that would be nice on Sundays or when we're feeling particularly religious. Finding our religious center is finding the place in our lives from which to view the rest of the crazy, chaotic, confusing, and brutal world that is flying by. Finding our religious center will allow us to have a new vision. We will no longer clutch at the people, places, and things that surround us as if they could support us, stabilize us, and give us meaning. Finding our religious center means that the banter of the midway will still be heard, but we will be less inclined to find direction there. Finding our religious center means that the sirens of life, all of them, will begin to become an opera of desire, want, and lack. We will finally reach that place in ourselves when what the world thinks we need, what Madison Avenue wants so desperately to sell us, what the drug companies want so desperately for us to ingest, all these maddening monologues will become the barkers of life. Every one of them will change at that point from the clamor that they are, the cacophony that they are, to simply the musical harmony of the spheres. Think of it this way. If a playwright writes a scene in which all the characters are speaking at once, what do you have? Chaos. But when somebody writes a libretto for an opera, there are times in which everyone is singing at the same time. And it's beautiful because harmony takes the place of understanding. When I worked on my master's of religion at Florida State University, my thesis was on nonverbal communication in Zen Buddhism, and I managed to write over 100 pages on that. I was Dr. Richard L. Rubenstein's assistant, the Richard L. Rubenstein who wrote the popular book After Auschwitz. This is what Dr. Rubenstein had to say about Buddhism. Quote, "I first became conscious of my affinity with Buddhism as a result of the encounter with Masio Abe during a job interview at the University of British Columbia in March of 1970. In the Vancouver lectures, I expressed my ideas about the death of God, explicitly and unambiguously. The next day, I met with the religious studies faculty. As was so often the case, the faculty consisted primarily of conservative, white, Protestant males. Not surprisingly, my ideas made them uncomfortable, especially ideas such as God after the death of God being the holy nothingness. As the faculty questioned me, I noticed a small, thin Japanese scholar seated on the floor in the corner behind me. He became increasingly agitated as the discussion continued. Finally, he jumped up and said, "I'll have you know what this man is saying is the essence of Mahayana Buddhism." "That's strange," I said. "I've never studied Mahayana Buddhism." "That proves my point," he yelled. "Zen Buddhism is often described in this manner, a special transmission outside scriptures, not depending on words or letters, directly pointing to the human heart, seeing into one's true nature." "Well, true nature, that sounds like a soul, doesn't it?" "It does. Your true nature isn't rolling around inside you, though, like a marble inside a guitar. Zazen, seated meditation, isn't turning yourself upside down or inside out until you lose your marbles. For Zen Buddhists to express their true nature, they sit. It's practice. I like to play tennis, and when I attended Yale, I was a good, steady player. I played with older men, younger men, women, children, teenagers, on grass, asphalt, clay, you name it. There's only one way to get better. Practice. To be here and now in the here and now seems idiotic and commonplace. Yet most of us do not live in the here and now. Coming back to the moment and to the breath is the awakening of one's true nature. There's nothing special about it. It simply is. Artists have described this as being in flow. For 7 years after I graduated from Yale, I sat at my computer and wrote over 30 screenplays. Nobody held a gun to my head. It was a drug for me. The more I sat, the more I was in flow with story, character, and plot, the happier I was. I've said this before, and I'll say this again. Much of my writing is simply stenography. All I do is write down what comes to me. To be in flow with story and character, we have to suspend disbelief. And when you suspend disbelief, anything is possible. Now, it sounds like to create, we have to suspend belief, make believe. But the truth is, most people disbelieve their ears, eyes, nose, tongue, heart, lungs, and body. Most look for clues outside themselves on how to behave. Yet, I'll say it again, we must suspend our disbelief. And as we suspend our disbelief, who is it or what is it that we hope to find at the religious center of ourselves? A great majority of the world's religions talk about a soul. In the next few moments, I'm going to skip over some of these world religions and say something about what they say about the soul. If I miss your particular religious flavor or non-religious flavor, I apologize in advance. Quote, "The soul is a non-material, non-tangible part of a person that is the central location of his, her personality, intellect, emotions, and will, the human spirit. Most religions teach that the soul lives on after the death of the body." That's from the World Encyclopedia. From the Dictionary of Buddhism, we have the definition of anatman, A-N-A-T-M-A-N, as, quote, "the key Buddhist doctrine that both the individual and the objects are devoid of any unchanging, eternal, or autonomous substratum." In other words, for Buddhists, there is no abiding self, no soul. However, in Buddhism, there is something called Buddha nature. The abbot at Zen Mountain Monastery, John Dido Lori, says this about Buddha nature. "Rather than positing an original defect or sin that needs to be transcended, in Buddhism we begin with the assumption of inherent perfection. Our practice is to return to the inherent perfection that's originally there. There's nothing to be transcended. There's just a lot of baggage that we need to unburden ourselves of." You see, originally within Buddhist thought, there was a lot of discussion about one's potential for becoming a Buddha, realizing one's Buddha nature. Finally, within Mahayana Buddhism, we get the notion that there is no distinction between practice and enlightenment. To sit in meditation is to be enlightened. It's there, this Buddha nature, this soul with no return ticket, this thing that we're born with but also dies with us. A present-day Zen master has this to say, "We usually assume that the world existed long before we were born, and that our birth is our entrance upon the stage of an already existing world. At the same time, we often assume that our death means our departure from this world, and that after our death, this world continues to exist." Now here's where he gets interesting. "My true self lives in reality, And the world I experience is one I alone can experience and not one anyone else can experience along with me. To express this as precisely as possible, as I am born, I simultaneously give birth to the world I experience. I live out my life along with that world, and at my death, the world I experience also dies. End quote. There's no soul to live on, but more importantly, there's no world left for the soul to be departed from. The Holy Quran is quick to remind us that everything in this drama of life posits only one soul, and here's what it says in the Holy Quran. The entire drama of this single soul serves only to express the divine attributes of the hidden treasures of love. So the next time you read a Bill Moyer speech or anything else that says that Quran teaches hate and separatism, you tell the people around you about the single soul that deserves the divine attributes of love. This, my friends, is what the Holy Quran teaches. Within Judaism, God breathed the breath of life into the nostrils of man in Genesis, and he, man, became a living soul. By the Maccabean period in Jewish history, the Greek concept of the immortality of the soul was finally incorporated in Jewish thought, but even all the Jews didn't believe that. In Jesus' time, the Pharisees believed in life after death, and the Sadducees denied. All of Greek Neoplatonist thought is an attempt to describe how everything comes from the One, much like light comes from the sun. Paul Tillich, arguably the 20th century most famous and an important Protestant theologian, says, "The soul is not primarily an immortal substance, but the principle of movement." This is very Greek. "It is that principle of movement which moves the stars, so the stars have souls. It is the principle of movement which moves animals and plants, so they have souls. It is the principle which moves our bodies, so we have souls. It is the principle which moves the whole universe, so there is a world soul." End quote. The essential thing about the individual soul and the world soul is, according to Tillich, its concept of being, it's ambiguous, doubtful, uncertain, and capable of multiple interpretations. Right here, Paul Tillich is sounding a lot like the UUA. The same Zen master goes on, "At its very essence, life is contradiction, and the flexibility to forbear and assimilate contradiction without being beaten down by it or attempting to resolve it. That flexible ability is our life force." I think this is a good definition of soul. A life force that's flexible enough not to be beaten down by contradiction, flexible enough to assimilate contradiction without attempting to completely resolve it. Within the Jewish mystical tradition, the Hasids believed that in the beginning everything was God and then God exploded. That will make a lot of people happy in this congregation, I'm sure. That which was most like God went furthest from God, much like poles of a magnet repel each other. The former rabbi and now death of God theologian Richard L. Rubinstein explained that Sigmund Freud stood on the shoulders of these same Hasidic rabbis when he came up with this theory of psychoanalysis. For a person to be whole again, that person would necessarily have to go deep into the darkness of the unconscious and find that spark of him or herself that when brought to consciousness would make them whole again, make them one again, make them God again. So how do we find our souls, our religious center? Why don't I tell you what happened to me as quickly as I can? How I found my way to this place of grace. I wanted to be a preacher since I was 10 years old. From the age of 10 to 18, I sat in the front row of every chapel I ever attended and took notes on every minister I ever heard. And believe me, that made lots of ministers nervous. When I graduated in 1969, the war in Vietnam was raging. Catholic priests and brothers Daniel and Philip Berrigan were convicted of destroying selective service records. Both Woodstock and Altamont happened the same year. That's unbelievable, isn't it? The United States landed a man on the moon. I had a decision to make. Either I was going to go to Canada or I was going to find a more creative way to avoid the draft. Just as others are proud that when called they answered the call, so too am I proud that when called to serve in what I saw to be a war of genocide, that I did not answer the call. I attended Perkins School of Theology, Southern Methodist University. 2/3 of the class that year were draft resistors. Given a high lottery number, I jumped from Perkins to the Religion Department at Florida State University, then to Star King School for the Ministry, then to Military Police School at Fort McClellan, Alabama, in the peacetime army. I felt like a pinball in a pinball machine, but finally I dropped down into a hole I couldn't get out of. The lights were going off, the bells were ringing, and I had another decision to make. How was I going to control my drinking? I went to my first AA meeting in Denver, Colorado in 1977. I was already a mile high when I got there. The first person to speak was a lovely young woman. She was missing an arm. The next person to speak was an intelligent-looking young man. He only had one leg. I left that meeting and went immediately to a liquor store. Obviously, I didn't have a problem with alcohol because I had both my arms and legs. 2 years later, on December the 23rd, 1979, two hellish years, I quit for good. I traded my pistol in for a typewriter, and I began telling stories on paper instead of in bars. 10 years after sobering up in 1989, I was accepted at the Yale School of Drama, got a formal education in telling stories. I graduated in 1992 with a Master's of Fine Arts in playwriting. 20 years after sobering up in 1999, I got fed up with the Hollywood system and decided I would write a one-man show. I could write it, I could act it, and I could produce it. I found a man, Thomas Jonathan Stonewall Jackson, when I was writing a novel about Mary Todd Lincoln, and I thought, this man is interesting. He doesn't say anything, and he loves domestic chores at home, and he goes out in the battlefield, and he's Attila the Hun. I taught homeless people to Bible study for 1 year because Jackson had taught a black Sunday school when it was against the law in Virginia to teach blacks to read. I became a Presbyterian because he was a Presbyterian. Flooded by childhood memories of what Jesus had meant to me, I became a Christian again after 30 years of being a Buddhist. In 2004, after nearly 3 years at Bright Divinity School, Texas Christian University, I realized who Jesus was. A man who saw that the kingdom of God was located within the human heart. I found my way back to the Maria Cannon Zen Center in Dallas, where I became a student of Ruben Hobito Sensei, but that's another sermon. The path I now walk is no different from the path that I've walked my entire life, with one exception. I now know where power lies. I know where God, or whatever you wish to call our ultimate concern, lives. There is only power by living in the present moment. For me to live in the past through regret or wishing I could do it all over again, is to put myself in the victim seat. To live in hope that things will someday be different without me doing anything is to put myself in a place of fear, future events appearing real. What I learned is that we must stop looking outside ourselves for anything at all. How do you know when you've reached a religious center? Trust me, you'll know. Better yet, trust yourselves. You'll know. It's that place where you experience a peace that passes all understanding and reasoning. There are times when looking for our souls or our religious center is a lot like wandering around town as a homeless person when you're a child of the richest family in town. Once you've found your religious center, there is no end to your resources. So what I've told you about the soul and our religious center is incomplete, ambiguous, perhaps even contradictory, such as the essence of life. Now, I want you to do something for me. I want you to place your right hand over your heart. We're not going to pledge allegiance to the flag, I promise. Now, put your left hand on the person to your left. Don't worry about the aisles. This isn't brain surgery. Let us assume an attitude of prayer. And as I know, in the Unitarian Church, nobody closes their eyes, so I'm not going to close mine either, because I can't read when my eyes are closed. Great Spirit, we come before you today as a group, a community of seekers, questioners, rebels, malcontents. Hollow, secondhand answers aren't for us. We want to know for ourselves. We want a special transmission outside of Scripture, not relying on words or letters, pointing directly to the human heart. We sense that we have been given something that yearns to know exactly what that something is. Some of us call this soul, some call it intellect, some mind, some big mind. Some of us don't have a name for it at all. As we are connected physically as one community, help us to realize that we all have our spiritual questions. Some of those questions were addressed this morning, but some of them were not, and quite honestly, we still question. It helped us to remember that when one dog is satisfied, all dogs wag their tails. At this moment, right now, within the sacred, within the boundless, within the timeless, let us feel with our right hand our hearts wagging within us. For truly, what has been good for even one of us has been good for all. Amen.